The journey is conversations with ordinary people about stories of transformation and how we may have had setbacks in our life and how we persevered through those, how we've learned from those obstacles, and how they've, you know, maybe helped us on our path today. Well, welcome to The Journey. My name is Kevin Polke, and I have a special guest with us today, Tony Montalbano. And Tony is someone that I've known, I don't know how many years now, but we've go back all the way to when you were in high school and I was coaching at Harlem High School. And yeah, we've had
probably been 25 years, which just sounds crazy.
Exactly. And then you may recognize, as listeners, you may recognize Tony's last name. Tony's brother Brian has been on the show a couple times talking about his journey of being a double heart transplant recipient, as well as the last time he was on just a few months ago, talking about the medication, the treatment that actually keeps him alive has now led to him battling cancer. And so, and I know, Tony, you've been a huge support for Brian during this time period, and a huge, huge fan and huge support of him. So, so welcome to the journey.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. And and same goes with my brother for me. Like, he's been a huge support for me in my life. And, you know, we caused our parents a lot of stress for different reasons growing up. To have, you know, two sons where, you know, had pretty chaotic lives in their youth. And just thinking back of, you know, my parents having to deal with my brother and his problems, and then me and my problems, you know, kind of simultaneously, I'm sure it was a lot for them. But, you know, me and my brother, especially in our family, have always been, you know, thick as thieves and very supportive of each other. And yeah, I was so glad to see him do this podcast and other podcasts, because he's got a great message to put out there, and he can help a lot of people. And I hope, you know, to do the same on this one for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't we start with a question that I always ask the guest is, when Tony has an opportunity, you know, you're a hardworking gentleman, man. So I know your story about that, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But when Tony has time for fun, what does Tony do for fun?
Oh, God, I love to off-road. I have an off-road race truck out in Arizona that I take out to the desert. Anything outdoors, I love. So hiking, mountain biking, all that kind of stuff. You know, I don't put like working out and stuff like that into my, like, you know, hobbies, because I feel like that's just my daily routine. It's just part of my day. I don't have an option. I just do it. But like, when I do have that free time, travel a lot and do anything adventurous is what I love.
Yeah. Awesome. And I know there's a ton of stories that we could talk about with that as well. So, well, why don't we kind of just jump into, you know, you and I first met when you were playing football and I was coaching football, and I was the strength and conditioning coach for Harlem High School in McChesney Park in Illinois. And you were, you know, involved with those types of activities. And then, you know, right after high school, yeah, tell us a little bit about what was going on in your life at that time. And I know that there's a critical part of your story right around that time period.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, obviously grew up, you know, in Loves Park and went to Harlem, and, you know, started getting into sports in high school. And, you know, I always, you know, I rode and raced BMX bikes when I was a kid. And then I was always like super active, had a punching bag in the basement. Rocky was my favorite movie, and I would do push-ups and sit-ups and ride my bike and hit the punching bag. So I was always into like working out. You know, growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, like every action hero is this big jack dude, and that's like who I wanted to be. So when I, you know, got into high school and started actually playing football and running track and doing those types of things, I started lifting weights when I was 15. And I remember it was, you know, Brad Sindel had gotten his license before all of us because he was the oldest out of our friend group. He had this little S10 pickup truck. We'd pile in there and go to the gym after school and in the summertime. And that's when I started lifting weights, and I just got completely obsessed with it. And then when I got into high school and then, you know, found you as the strength and conditioning coach, like, I think that's where we made our first connection, because I was so into lifting weights and you were so knowledgeable. And there was a few people on the team that really took the weightlifting serious, like me and Jerry Foss and, you know, a couple other guys. And you, like, were there to kind of direct us and teach us the right techniques and all that. And I always, you know, give you kudos when I talk about my workout journey, because, you know, you seeing that drive in a couple of young men and trying to steer us in the right direction is why I stuck with it, you know. So kudos to you on that, and thank you for that. But I, you know, at 15, 16, I was struggling with anxiety and stuff like that. So I was, you know, seeing counselors and trying to work through that, you know, with my brother being sick most of my life and kind of a, you know, divided household and my parents, you know, it was, I just had a lot going on and nobody really kind of checking on me, I want to say. You know, my parents loved me to death, but, you know, they had, you know, my brother who was, you know, his heart was trying to kill him every few months. So they were, you know, focused on keeping him around, and not a ton of energy went into, like, you know, I wonder if Tony's doing all right. And because of that, and I have no, you know, resentment, I just understand that's how it goes, but it, I think because of that, I just didn't have a lot of direction. So I started seeking it out. And then ultimately, you know, me and you started working together, but, you know, through that journey, I was still struggling with anxiety and depression. And then at 17, one of my best friends died in an accident, and, you know, watched him bleed to death in front of me. And then that is really what spiraled me into addiction and alcohol and experimenting with drugs, because I had all this pain and all this anxiety, and now this happened. And then I was like, man, I can't deal with it. Let me deal with it by drinking and doing drugs and trying to numb the pain. And that was at 17. And then by, you know, 22, you know, after 5 years of partying like that and trying to numb the pain, it got to be too much. And I was getting in a lot of trouble. And ultimately, which a lot of listeners, if they're in Rockford, will remember this story, but, ultimately, got into a bar fight at 22 years old and accidentally, you know, killed somebody and ended up facing a first degree murder charge at 22. And then for the next year and a half, until my trial, I was in and out of county jail. I was on house arrest, until my trial in 2007. And then I was found not guilty on self-defense. And then as soon as I could, I packed my stuff and moved as far away from Rockford as humanly possible.
Yeah. I remember that time period. And I think this is for any listener out there, you know, when they, oh, that won't happen to me. You know, from what I remember you telling me the story was when you say accidentally, you know, someone died as a result of, if I remember correctly, it was just one punch. And it just was, when they talk about the way you describe it to me about it being a fluke, that just how you happened to hit him, but it was when he landed was the result of, unfortunately, his passing. And that's a tragic, not only for him, but then the ripple effect on you and your family and everybody around. And that's just a horrible situation where, you know, we can say it now because we're old, but there's not necessarily a good reason to be fighting. Right.
And no, so, never. Yeah. And that, like I always say, that's the last fight I'll ever get in, because, you know, I realized the ramifications of it. And, you know, at the time, and I was getting in, it's not like this is just happened. It's not like I was, you know, going to church every Sunday and, you know, this, you know, super, it wasn't like I was good in society back then. let's put it that way. So it was just like, it was the way I was living my life that ultimately, you know, led up to this incident. It wasn't, you know, I know we talk about it as, you know, this was like a one-time fluke thing, but something was going to happen. You know, I wasn't slowing down with the partying and the drinking and the drugs and the fighting. So, you know, it's funny because in my mugshot, I have a black eye that, you know, from my mugshot that night, but that black eye didn't occur that night. It occurred, you know, a week earlier when I got in another fight at another party, you know? So it was just this lifestyle I was living that ultimately, you know, ended me up, you know, in county jail. And, you know, like you said, yeah, it was one punch. And then, like you said, the ripple effect, something you said, you know, cause me and you were talking back then and you were helping me through some things. And the one thing you said that always comes to mind is, you know, you said, you were the first person to ask me, you know, or how are you doing with the guilt? And I started answering it as, you know, well, I don't think I'm guilty because this happened. You know, I was really defending myself. And you said, no, not the guilt of the situation, like the guilt of the ripple effect and the stress it's putting on, you know, your family and all this stuff, because, you know, they were writing articles about me in the newspaper and I was on the news all the time. And it was the first time I really thought about that. And I think about that, you know, ever since. It's like, man, I did put everybody through a lot, not only me and my family, but, you know, the victim and his family. And, you know, that guilt is something that, you know, I don't know if it ever goes away, and I don't know if I want it to be honest, because it's kind of that my responsibility in that incident is, it's a reminder to, you know, never go back to being that person. And as I tell my story on podcasts or just, you know, to whoever, I tell everybody, like, I almost like look at my life as two different lives, and it's, you know, everything that happened, you know, before I was 25, right? Like that, all the chaos and the trauma I went through from, you know, the day I was born until, you know, the day I left for California. And it really feels like a different person, because the minute I moved to California in 2008, and I picked San Diego literally on a map because it was the furthest place from Rockford and Chicago, and I could get away and I won't have an excuse to go back. Like, I'm all in on moving. And the weather helped, of course, but, you know, ever since I moved it, you know, every day of my life, I just decided I want to be a different person and live a different life. And I wrote something down the morning I woke up in San Diego. The first morning I woke up, I remember writing down, you know, you're one step away from greatness. So, like, make every day count, basically. Like, you never know what's going to come. So every day you live from here on out, take that day as an opportunity to get better and find opportunities and create your own luck and, you know, prove to yourself and your family and whoever else is listening that, hey, I'm not this person anymore that got in all this trouble and was chaotic. You know, I can actually, you know, live a great life and be a contributor to, you know, other people's success and happiness. And that's what I've done ever since.
Well, and I, you know, it's interesting when you talk about that. And I remember us having those conversations, you know, while you were waiting for your trial and all that time period. And I, you know, I never saw that Tony living in the lifestyle, right? Because you weren't that way in the gym. You weren't that way on the football field or the track. And so I only got to see that Tony, right? And, you know, someone who was hardworking, someone who was absorbing everything and open to anything that I was teaching you about fitness, you know, and to push yourself and those things. But to your point, our lifestyle is at some point, if we stay in that type of lifestyle too long, and we almost always have warning signs, right? That we should be getting out, or something happened maybe the week before when you got in that fight and you got a black eye, whatever it is. But the fear of who we're going to be if we step out, if we stop, usually keeps us in it until something tragic. Like, and ironically, not everyone wakes up, right? Some people go victim and then they or go angry, and then they just become, they use that as the excuse, as or the, yeah, I guess the excuse to say, now I'm going to be a criminal because that's what you're calling me, so now I'm going to be that, instead of saying, no, I can let that part of me die so that I can rebirth and transform into something else. And so tell us a little bit about when you go out to California, you go out to San Diego, you don't have anything, if I remember the story correctly, you don't have anything but the vehicle you drove in and some a couple suitcases or whatever. So tell us the story about what you did once you got out there, and how that part of the ride go.
Yeah, so I'll touch on one thing real quick before I get into that because of what you just said. But I think I had a good solid base. I think it was literally just all the trauma that got me drinking and doing drugs and all that. And a lot of it was drinking by myself and like drinking to forget, not partying to have a good time. I was only partying just to like numb the pain. And once all that did happen, it was like, hey, I am a good person on the inside. It was all this trauma and depression and anxiety that was causing all the abuse. And once I realized that, at the culmination, then it was like, all right, well, let me just dig into this part of my person, and this is what I want to work on, not, and I can, let go of the other stuff. So, that's kind of how I looked at it. But to answer your question, moving out to California, you're exactly right. I mean, it's not easy getting and I was an electrician, in Chicago and the suburbs and all that, before I moved. And, the housing market crashed, like 07, 08. So it was kind of perfect timing. Like, after my trial, I got laid off. Yeah, everybody got laid off because the housing market crashed, and I just had nothing to lose. And I packed my stuff, me and my dog Tank, and we jumped in my truck and literally drove to California with $3,500 to my name and a pickup truck. Got out there, and with four felony arrests in the last couple years, even though I wasn't convicted of a felony, I had this arrest record that was, not easy to overcome when you're trying to apply for jobs, because when they do a background check, they see all that. So I got out to California. I was applying for every job under the book. Couldn't get hired anywhere, with my skill set. And I ended up working nights at a food for less grocery store, making $10 an hour stocking shelves until I could figure something else out. And then, by the grace of God or whoever you believe in, during that time, I found a Craigslist ad for a gig, and it said, come in and build 10 beach cruisers every morning for $100 cash. And I was like, all right, I can build some beach cruisers, never done it before, but it can't be that hard. I'm handy. So I met, the owner of this company who was just starting a bicycle shop in San Diego down in Pacific Beach. I was there like an hour before they opened. I sat there and waited for him. He got there. I said, hey, I need this job. Cancel all your other interviews. Hire me. I can do this. And he's like, well, I got so many interviews. He wrote down my information. And then I called him like three times that day. And by the third time I called him, he said, is this the dude that you came in this morning? You were the one waiting for me. I go, yeah. He goes, just start tomorrow. Whatever. Like, I'm sick of interviewing people. So I started the next day, and within a week, all 10 bikes I was building, we were selling the same day. So then, maybe 2 weeks into this gig, he's like, I need to hire you full time. So I quit the night job and just went all in on this bike shop. And I was like, hey, until the economy comes back around, I can get a job being an electrician. I'm just going to work at this bike shop. But we were growing so fast, and I was building out the service department and products and point of sale system. And I was wrapping my head around this whole business. And then that first winter I was out there, the owner of this bicycle shop I was working for, he bought a house that needed to be completely remodeled. And he's like, hey, listen, I just put all my money into this house, and I need to save some money for this rehab. Can you help me rehab this house over the next 3 months, and then I'll give you some equity into the bike shop. And I said, absolutely. So I ended up working basically for free for months over the wintertime, remodeling this house. And then there on out, I was getting paid really well, at the bike shop. A couple years later, opened my own shop over by San Diego State, and then got really lucky again there. And I keep saying lucky, meaning I took opportunity and seized it. But, I opened this bike shop by San Diego State, the restaurant right next door, right when Yelp was brand new. They ended up being the highest rated restaurant in the country for Yelp reviews. And they were wanted to expand. So they bought me out of my lease for a big chunk of change and moved into the spot I had. And then me and the original guy that hired me at the original bike shop, we flew to China. We started, touring factories. We started manufacturing our own bikes, started importing them and distributing them all up and down the West Coast, all the way out to Arizona, and ended up opening the highest volume retail bicycle shop in San Diego, at one point, and operated, that business for, 13, 14 years and eventually sold it. And then moved out here to North Carolina to start another business. So it's been crazy. The last, 18 years or however long it's been, it's been a complete transformation, and it's all starts with, the mindset and the discipline. And, I tell people my superpower is hitting rock bottom, because, at 22 years old, I remember sitting in jail. They gave me a high risk jumpsuit. So I had a yellow jumpsuit, which is like having a target on your back in county. I'm locked up with, class 4, class X felons. The jumpsuit didn't even fit me. I had to wrap it around my waist. I didn't have a shirt on. I got all these stupid tattoos. And I remember just sitting in jail, and I was just like, this ain't me. I don't want to be here. This is a complete waste of time. And I'm not these other people. I'm not like them at all. I'm better than this. And no matter what happens, if I stay in jail the rest of my life, or if I get out, no matter what the outcome is, I'm just going to be a better person. And I made that conscious decision, and I've just stuck to it ever since.
Well, and I think, you know my story, and I've talked about it before, is that, for me, what I learned as I was playing football and wrestling and running track and then later competing as a bodybuilder, it's what I learned along that line was much more valuable than anything I ever accomplished as an outcome, meaning like a title that I won or, whatever was on the football field or whatever. And that, I think, that along with, I have a similar story of hitting a rock bottom, and that wake up call of this lifestyle, I can't get away with this anymore. I can't play this way. This is not who I am. And that doesn't make any, judgment on anybody else that was there. It's just that I just knew that it wasn't me. And to the point where, like you said, the anxiety is that, I think we had this conversation too, is that, a person who has criminal thinking, they're innocent until proven guilty. Someone who doesn't have criminal thinking is guilty till proven innocent. And it doesn't matter if you're literally in a cell or you're outside. If you don't have the mindset of a criminal, that hanging over your head is you're in prison. And that's why sometimes people, they're still carrying around that guilt and shame, even after they've been liberated. They don't have that freedom because they're still living in who they were. And, mm-hmm. And so I think, from your standpoint of what you just shared, I think, and I, we've had many conversations, and that is truly what you've done. And there's one piece I want you to mention before we leave San Diego and go to North Carolina. I remember we were talking, and that little thing happened. And I think this resilience piece of it, I want you to share with the audience, is that little pandemic thing happened, and that changed everything, including, the market for everybody. But talk a little bit about what you did during that time period, to, I don't want to say, it's probably not the right words, but capitalize on the need that people had for bikes in California, at that time. What do you remember about that time period of innovation and creativity?
Yeah, that was a crazy time for everybody, obviously. And my experience with COVID was way different than everybody else's. So I'll preface it as that. One thing I want to say about, like you just said, about hitting rock bottom and making that decision, I feel like, getting arrested and being in the spotlight for that is what like exposed my personal problems. And I felt really vulnerable. I'm like, oh shoot, like everybody knows I'm struggling now. Like I kept it this little dirty secret for so long, but now it's out there in the open and it's exposed. And that was really what led me to start healing, as tragic as it was, and too bad it came to that point. But I think that talking about stuff like that and talking about your issues and what you're going through and being public with it, or even with your friends, I mean, just being open about your struggles will expose, who you truly are and what you need help with. And that is the first step in healing, and I think the audience should know that is if that never happened to me, who knows what would have happened. Maybe I would have ended up dead, but it's that exposure of the truth and what you're struggling with and the trauma that helps you, start to heal. But to get back to the COVID point, yeah. So, we had ups and downs in the bike business, and one of the first big dips we had was when all the Bird scooters and Lime scooters and all these bikes on the corner that you could rent for $1, they popped up. And our sales got cut in half. Our rental fleet got cut by like 90%. And it was the first time in a long time where, we were like, holy smokes, something needs to change, right? And all these other bike shops were at the time, trying to fight against, all these rideshare scooters and bikes on the street. And what me and my business partner said was, well, that's a losing battle. These companies have millions and millions of dollars being pumped into this. There's no way they're disappearing. How do we capitalize on these companies? And we took the active, stance of getting a hold of, Bird scooters and saying, hey, who's doing your maintenance on these things? We haven't even thought about maintenance. And we're like, cool. Well, we have an empty warehouse in, up north here. Drop all the ones off that you need help with. We'll fix them and you can pay us to fix them. And because of doing that, we made tons of money doing that over the next few months. And that kept us afloat for the downfall in which, they were responsible for. So it was kind of if you can't beat them, join them kind of thing. So we were resilient during that time, and then we started importing our own scooters. We were selling them, to end buyers, and we just went all in on these scooters thing since that was the craze. So we were able to keep afloat during this time when a lot of companies were falling off. They owed all these, manufacturers and distribution companies a bunch of money because their sales got cut in half and they didn't pivot. But because we pivoted, we were making enough money to pay our vendors and pay our manufacturers and keep good relationships, even though, we didn't pay ourselves for months and months, maybe 6 to 9 months. We were not making any money, but we were just staying afloat. And, because of that, when COVID did hit, there was all this news saying, bike shops are going to be shut down. And about 2 or 3 days of that started happening, and we were staying open, and there was cops showing up at all these bike shops, closing them down. And then by day three, they finally said, all right, bicycle shops are, are able to stay open because of transportation. And that day, me and my partner were like, he calls me and he goes, dude, we got like 2,000 bikes sitting in China right now. Do you think we should ship them over here now or see what happens? And I was like, let's ship them over here right now. You know, and this was like March and of what, 2020?
Yep.
So then we get the bike shipped, and literally like the day they land in port and get to our warehouse is when the news starts saying, hey, there's no longer a toilet paper shortage. There's now a bicycle shortage. And we had all this inventory that we owned cash, you know, almost about $1 million in inventory. And where everybody else had been dying because of, you know, the scooter craze, they owed all these companies money. They didn't have any inventory. They didn't own any inventory. They couldn't capitalize on COVID because they had nothing to sell. It was such a bummer for everybody, all these bike shops, because they're like, I have a line around the block with nothing to sell and I can't order anything. Where we had, you know, thousands of bikes in stock and we had good relationships with all the manufacturers. So even if somebody needed something, like every single day during COVID, I would call everybody I bought bikes and parts from, and I'd say, what do you have today? And they'd be like, we just got 30 extra small women's hybrids. And I'd be like, send them all to me. I'll take them. Because for an entire year, I had a line around the block at the bike shop. And, you know, May of 2020 was when it really hit. And we sold like 1600 bikes in 30 days. So my COVID experience was a little different than everybody else's, where I owned my own business, you know, I created my own paycheck and my own destiny, and we stayed open the entire time. I didn't, you know, wear a mask or anything, you know, I just kind of just business as usual and just kept stayed open and made more money than I ever made in my life that year. So, you know, I was just fortunate that we pivoted when we did, and we always kept good relationships. We never burned any bridges. And every time life throws an obstacle at you, figure out how to capitalize on it. It's not always a negative thing. You know, it's like, try and find the good in it and say, you know, the scooters hit and there wasn't an easy way out, we would have shut down the bike shop and started another business. You know, we started so many businesses doing all this other stuff. We were building 4x4 off-road vans on the side. We were starting to build sheds for, you know, for homeowners, like anything we could make money on. We weren't passionate about the bicycle industry. We were passionate about making money and being entrepreneurs. So it could be any product. We would just figure out how to make money on it. So that's, you know, that's what got us through that. And, you know, it was kind of the same thing with me moving out here to North Carolina, where, you know, the bike business boomed for a few more years. And then I started seeing it starting to level off and decline. And I was like, you know, I don't want to keep all my eggs in this basket. And a good friend of mine who was out in Florida had, you know, exited his last company, and me and him were talking over the, you know, through COVID. And he's like, hey, if we figure out something to do together, you know, do you want to do it? I said, absolutely. We were throwing ideas out to each other all the time. And then one finally stuck, and it was wholesaling real estate. And he said, you know, I'm moving from Fort Lauderdale up to Raleigh, North Carolina. You know, me and my wife want you to join us as a partner. And I said, yeah, I believe in you, and I want to take another risk. And, I believe in myself. And again, I packed my stuff with no real plan, no guarantees, and packed my truck and moved across the country again and started this business. And that was almost 3 years ago, and ended up selling the bicycle business and went all in on what I'm doing now. And that's, you know, I have a call center right outside my door here where, you know, we have 15 employees and they're all on the phones, locking up houses under contract. And then I have a team that sells those contracts to investors. I flip houses, I buy and hold rentals. And, you know, I can, you know, say that, you know, I also have, you know, an education side of the business where I teach this and I teach sales training. And that's a big part to do with you and the advice you gave me, you know, a couple years ago when I said, you know, coach, I'm making more money than I've ever made. I have no worries financially or otherwise, and I'm still not completely fulfilled. And you said, well, you know, that's not your purpose. Like, you need to find, you know, what brings you joy and purpose in life and living a life of purpose. And every time I would talk to you about training somebody, you said, you know, you light up every time you talk about that. Why don't you dig into that? And, you know, I put a lot of time and effort into my brand and on social media and starting to train people. And, you know, fast forward 2 years now, it's a big part of my life and my business, and the thing that keeps me happy and going every day is teaching what I do here in my office and helping others, you know, better themselves and ultimately make more money for them and their family.
I remember us having that conversation, and like you had said earlier, about it wasn't about the bike business back then. It was about being entrepreneurial and making money and making businesses grow and thrive. And I remember listening to you talk about the excitement coming in your voice when you would talk about teaching others and helping others and coaching others, and once again, that entrepreneurial part of you then figured out, all right, how can I not just do this, but then do it in a way that that becomes another revenue stream as well. And so when we can capitalize and figure out how do we monetize something that we do for free anyways, then we're in that space, right? Then we're in that, like a runner's high. I don't know if I've ever had a runner's high, but that's a different issue.
Yeah, I think I've had it one time. Yeah. I've been chasing that dragon ever since.
Yeah. I mean, running's just painful. but I do know when either, and I know you've talked about the same experience when you're on stage and you're either teaching, you know, telling your story or teaching to a larger audience, or when it's just a one-on-one or a small group, it's the same flow, it's the same feeling. So I know recently, and I want to see if you can try to put into what you're put into some words what this experience was recently. You told me about you went to a mastermind and or maybe it wasn't a mastermind, but it was like a three-day retreat thing, and Jocko was one of his retreats. So tell us a little bit about what that experience was for you, and what did you take away from that experience?
Yeah, Jocko Willink. So, you know, he's somebody I've followed for a long time on social media, and just, you know, his discipline just you know, people always say, oh, Tony, you're so disciplined, you're a psychopath, you know they think I'm crazy disciplined because I do all these fitness challenges and all this stuff, and I work so much and I stay disciplined. But, you know, following somebody like Jocko makes me realize I have so many other aspects of my life I can be disciplined in. And, you know, an opportunity came up where I could go to one of his events, the Echelon event in San Diego. So I went out there, and it was a 2 full-day event where, you know, I got to meet him and Leif and work out with them every morning, and then listen to them and their team for 2 full days and do, you know, group activities for leadership. And it was just like a leadership event. And I was just another dude in the crowd. Like, there was no VIP tickets. There was nothing. Like, everybody's on the same page and everybody's there to learn. And it was a life-changing experience for me, simply because the common theme during the entire presentation over 2 days on leadership was really just being humble and killing your ego, creating relationships. And it's not about what life throws at you. You're never going to be able to change that. You have no control over that. It's about how you react to that and how you communicate through that, in the relationships that you have and the relationships you're trying to build. So that, like, humility theme and killing the ego theme and just going heavy on relationships and communication has changed my perspective forever. to actually witness, you know, training and physically training at 4:30 in the morning with Navy SEALs, you know, for a few days, and listening to the way they speak and seeing how they present themselves. It just gave it that alone was humbling, because I'm like, hey, you know, all these people give me props and you can start drinking your own juice. But once you, you know, have a mentor, you know, like yourself, you know, I consider you a mentor, and, you know, Jocko and people like that, where it really humbled me and it put me in perspective of how do I stay more disciplined in every aspect of my life, first of all, and how do I create good relationships, and how is my communication going to get better? How can I get better in all these aspects, which will ultimately make me a better friend, a better leader, a better everything. So, yeah, it was a game changer for me.
Well, and what caught my attention after you came back from that and we talked, you know, maybe 2 weeks afterwards, and I asked you how it went. And I remember what stood out to me was your first comment that you said, I got some work to do. And I went, oh, okay, what do you mean? And then you know, you told me a little bit about it. So I ended up picking up the audio version of Extreme Ownership. And maybe it's something about listening to their voices, different than reading it off the book, you know, off the pages or whatever. But I remember I was driving to my Milwaukee office, and in the first section of it, he goes into a story, and maybe it's like you said, it's these Navy SEALs. So you're immediately humbled, because there's no way that I'm going to be able to, you know, there's no way I can compare myself, you know. But he talked about something about this idea of extreme ownership, and what popped in my mind was something I experienced in 2023, and even though I you know, I want to say that I took it with a level of integrity. There was a little bit of me that wasn't looking at what part did I play into it. And maybe it was true. Maybe 99% of it was this other group of people and whatever. But until I was listening to that, I had to take a look at the 1% or the 2% that was mine. And man, I did not want to. I mean, I was like, I was fighting it, and I was just, but it wouldn't let me go. It already got its claws in me. And so I had to, you know, take a look. Okay, what was my 2%? What did I do? What did I not do? What could I have done different? What was the reason I didn't do it this way? Why did I, you know, whatever it was. And that has, and I wasn't even there with you, but just vicariously listening to you talk about it, listen to the book, you know, I think that's the awesome thing about, if we choose to be open and choose to follow that nudge or that intuition, we always have an opportunity to continue to grow and develop. And that's one of the things that ever since when you were a teenager to all the different life adventures that you've had, the setbacks as well as the opportunity to thrive, that's one of the things that I've appreciated about, you know, walking with you on your path, because I've gained things as well. And so I appreciate you, Tony, and everything that you're doing and what you're still giving back to the people around you.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Yeah, I feel, you know, truly blessed that, you know, I met you, you know, at such a young age, and you've seen me, you know, go through my life. You know me, you know my family, you know my ups and downs, my struggles, and, you know, to be able to connect with somebody, you know, who, you know, I see us as being, having a lot of similarities, being, you know, spiritual and open-minded and also, like, you know, disciplined and entrepreneurs and humble. Like, yeah, you've been a great role model for me. And, yeah, I'm truly blessed to have you in my life, and I appreciate you having me on this podcast. And, yeah, the extreme ownership, that's what I got out of it, is you can control your life simply by the way you react. And the minute you stop blaming others for your problems and start blaming yourself for lack of a better word, or just taking responsibility and knowing how I react to this situation is going to be the outcome. You're never going to change what hits you, but you can change the outcome by how you react and adapt to it. And, you know, that extreme ownership piece is what keeps me humble. And I don't care if it's somebody on a, you know, the lowest tier of my company, like I'm humble enough to know this person knows stuff I don't know. And if they come to me or we're having an issue, I first look inward and say, what did I do? Did I not teach them properly? Did I not communicate properly? The reason they're struggling today is 100% my fault. And the minute you start switching your mind to that in business, in life, relationships, friendships, you know, your health, your wealth, everything, your life can truly change. And I'm forever grateful for you know, those lessons and the lessons you teach me. And you know, I love this podcast. I listen to, you know, not every episode, but I do listen to a lot of episodes. And you know, you're doing a great job of getting that message out there and the hero's journey. And you know, everybody goes through hardships. It's really how you react to them and how you change and learn is what gets you, you know, to the top. So yeah, appreciate you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Tony. If someone wanted to reach out to you and get to know more about what you're doing and more about your teaching company, as well as your leadership company, what's the best way for people to get a hold of you and follow you?
Yeah. Instagram's the best way, @TheTonyMont. On Instagram and YouTube and all that. I have a podcast called You Are Not Normal, because my whole life, you know, since I was a little kid, everybody told me I wasn't normal, which is not a bad thing. It's a great thing, and I embrace it. So yeah, I have a podcast, You Are Not Normal. It's The Tony Mont on YouTube, but everything is funneled through my Instagram, The Tony Mont. And I only put The Tony Mont. Everybody knows me as Tony Mont now instead of Tony Montalbano, because you're probably the only person that can pronounce it right, because if you know me for 25 years. So when I go on podcasts and people are like, how do you say it? I'm just say Tony Mont. Let's just get past it. So.
Awesome. All right. Well, Tony, thank you very much for being with us. And I'll definitely, you know, I'd love to have you on sometime in the future and being able to share what the new adventure is, because there always is going to be something new with you. So again, thanks for being here. If there's anything that Tony and I were talking about, I think probably the biggest piece that I'd want to reiterate is that being able to change your perspective of owning your side of the street, and that when obstacles happen, because they're going to happen, when setbacks happen and they're going to happen, how can you change your perspective looking at them as a teacher, and what do they have to reveal to you for your next opportunity for growth and development? As always, I appreciate you being here, and definitely reach out to Tony on his Instagram, and look forward to being with you next week. The journey is conversations with ordinary people about stories of transformation and how we may have had setbacks in our life and how we persevered through those, how we've learned from those obstacles, and how they've, you know, maybe helped us on our path today.